are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 22nd, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report, broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a brand new interview that Sam Steeder just did with Dale Barron. It came from something awful, how a toxic troll army accidentally memed Donald Trump, the chosen one, into office. The chosen one was my joke, not the full title of the book. That interview was recorded just recently. Bernie Sanders unveils a $16 trillion Green New Deal plan to combat the climate crisis, achieve full employment on the heels of a radical labor and criminal justice plans. I guess more folks have plans now and a movement. ABC News reporting on the fires blazing through the Amazon. Fires set into play by the fascistic Brazilian government, in spite of lies from the Bolsonaro regime that they were set by NGOs. This in conjunction with already a rights crisis facing indigenous people in Brazil, ecocide and ethnic cleansing, on the heels of 500 days of the political imprisonment of Lula da Silva. However, Congressman Hank Johnson, along with Ro Khanna, Ilhan Omar, Susan Weil, Veronica Escobar, and several others have called on the DOJ to provide answers for its close coordination with the Lava Jato investigation, which put Lula in jail and set the stage for the destruction of the Amazon. Trump says he's seriously looking at ending birthright citizenship on the heels of wanting to detain children indefinitely in camps. Time to be serious. In fact, it already was well timed to be serious. 70 mayors sign a letter opposing the Trump administration's proposal to restrict access to food stamps. At least 8 jail officials knew that Jeffrey Epstein was not to be left alone in his cell. But yet somehow it still happened. Is this who we are? Are we really a giant CIA operation? Jay Inslee is ending his climate change driven campaign for president. The only one, besides, I guess, Bill de Blasio, fresh off of the heels of calling for the freeing of Leonard Peltier, who should not drop out. Congress pumps brakes on an interior push to relocate the Bureau of Land Management to make it easier for land exploitation. And Trump says he's got a great Medal of Honor winner in mind. Can you guess who that Medal of Honor winner might be? Any guesses? Who would Donald Trump like to award the Medal of Honor? One word, guess. Give me one name. Come on, guys.
Don King.
That is a great guess. It is not true, but I love the thinking. Myself. I would like very much to award myself a Medal of Honor. Thank you. A Medal of Honor winning. I'm not mentioned. So stupid. So stupid.
It's called the Medal of the King of Jerusalem.
There's a lot of analysis about the new anti-Semitism coming from the Trump gang yesterday. And I think we covered a lot of it. But I don't remember if we put this take forward yesterday, but I forget who. I think it was Orisa on Twitter. And I apologize, this isn't in the prep. I just remembered this. But the point of the tweet was, this is also just being super pissed. Because in Trump's head, he doesn't have any historical or analytic awareness of anything. So he's given and indulged the far-right regime of Israel of their every single wish. And he still can see a poll that Jewish voters aren't flipping to him. So he's livid. And I think that's 100% true.
Yeah, don't tell me we're not backsliding on race when they're bringing back old forms of bigotry that we haven't even seen in a while.
I mean, so many different things are happening on race right now, including, I don't even know, backsliding, reinvention of apartheid for the 21st century. But no doubt. And that's why I always say there's only one place where fascism is safe for Jews. I mean, I'm being a little flippant, but that's also like a serious point. You know, I wouldn't get too comfortable in any type of authoritarian, far-right-leaning regime if you're Jewish, even if there's a marriage of convenience with the far-right authoritarians in Israel. But let's get to Brazil. We know, and it has been repeated, that the Amazon is a core fulcrum in the Earth's planetary system. We already know that we're in an ecological crisis. This is B-roll of the fires in the Amazon. Now, it's very important to note, and I just want to say here, I mean, look, and also how the fires are affecting cities in Brazil. It's very important to be real here that this is a political project. This is inseparable from the Bolsonaro government. This is inseparable from the U.S. backing of things like Lava Jato, the Wall Street endorsement of J.R. Bolsonaro. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, on the day that Bolsonaro won, put out a tweet saying, you know, he's controversial, but great business opportunities. So it's extremely important that we frame and understand what this is, which is that J.R. Bolsonaro, along with the Republican Party, is the greatest threat to human survival on planet Earth right now. That this is a political decision. This is an ecocide and a global ecological threat. And it's also absolutely a form of ethnic cleansing of the Brazilian indigenous communities. And that there is a long policy set which implicates the Obama administration, the DOJ, Wall Street, mining and ag businesses that lead to this moment we're in, which is literally life and death for the entire planet. This is a report from Brian Mayer. He's a reporter, of course, for Telesur and also co-editor of Brazil Wire, which is the indispensable Brazil resource everybody needs to read, reporting from Sao Paulo yesterday on the fires.
I'm standing on the north side of Sao Paulo, where the entire city is engulfed in smog, as it has been since Monday, in a weather phenomenon that's related to smoke coming up from the Amazon rainforest, where thousands of fires are currently raging. Now, every year in the dry season in the Amazon region, small farmers and ranchers practice slash and burn agriculture techniques. They burn the scrub on their land, and it creates nutrients in the soil. It's not good for the environment, but it's hard to convince them to stop doing it. But what's happening this year is different. President Jair Bolsonaro is giving out signals to the big loggers and agribusiness companies that they can invade natural parks and indigenous reservations and chop down trees and burn whatever they want. And so there's huge fires out of control. Animals are dying. And the risk is that if he continues acting this way, there could be a phenomenon called dieback, in which the entire forest could burn down uncontrollably if it reaches a certain point of deforestation. And some biologists are predicting this could happen by 2030. Now, if Bolsonaro stays in power acting this way, the odds are that this is really going to happen. And since the Amazon provides the world with 20% of its oxygen, it would be a catastrophe.
J.R. Bolsonaro is the greatest threat to human survival on planet Earth right now. But, you know, by extension, obviously, the United States government, the corporations that have backed him. And this needs to be understood politically. It needs to be understood economically. And we'll certainly get back to, you know, the latest about the political imprisonment of Lula. But everybody who, first of all, backed and orchestrated this process and then uncritically covered it has a direct stake and implication in something that literally threatens the future of the entire planet and is a crisis, a profound crisis in Brazil right now. Several weeks ago, an indigenous leader was murdered. This also correlates with regular shootings of activists and organizers in Brazil, ongoing threats legal and extrajudicial against Glenn Greenwald. And just 2 weeks ago or a week ago, Marielle Franco's wife, her widow, went to go visit Lula in prison. Marielle, of course, was assassinated by a cartel that a lot of reports can link to the Bolsonaro family. So that's what's happening, and it is a matter of utmost urgency. We have, I guess, an ad to get to, and then we will come right back with Sam's interview. But Sam gave you this pitch.
Thanks, Michael. Before we get to author Dale Barron on his book, It Came From Something Awful, How a Toxic Troll Army Accidentally Memed Donald Trump into Office, let me just remind you folks, now that the weather is still a little bit warmer, might be time to switch up your sheets and duvets to something a little breezier. From Brooklinen's newest linen collection, these beautiful airy linen pieces that give your bedroom a certain chic. Do you hear that, Matt?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Gives you a relaxed feel.
That's what my bedroom's like.
Yes, I can imagine. They don't have a gamer's version of this. But these things, they have a relaxed feel. They give you the ultimate comfort, and they look a little bit stylish. Not to mention, available 12 different colors and patterns. My Brooklinen sheets, it's very hard for me to disaggregate a lot of changes over my life over the past year and a half. You know, marital status changing. That means sleeping arrangements changing. That means I get to choose which sheets I wear, use all the time. My Brooklinen sheets, it's hard for me to disaggregate the different emotions I'm feeling, but I'm feeling great. And part of it, I know, is my Brooklinen sheets. I don't want to go too deep into that, but they honestly, they look great. They feel great. They get better as you sleep on them. I have just now, it's just like they're my favorite t-shirt, except for I get to sleep in it every night. And it's in your name. It's in their name. So you know that Brooklinen's newest linen collection is amazing. Like I say, I can't recommend their products more. Graduates, newlyweds, friends, family, treating yourself to a bedroom upgrade you deserve. And now Brooklinen.com is giving my listeners an exclusive offer. Get 10% off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident that you're going to love their sheets or their comforters, towels, pillows. They all come from with a lifetime warranty. The only way to get 10% off and free shipping, use promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. Now we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll be talking to Dale Barron about his book.
Best sheets ever. Do you see? All right, guys. We have an interview now with Sam Cedar and Dale Barron, author of It Came From Something Awful, How a Toxic Troll Army Accidentally Memed Donald Trump into Office. We'll be right back.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program freelance journalist, former cartoonist and author of It Came From Something Awful, How a Toxic Troll Army Accidentally Memed Donald Trump into Office. Dale Barron, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's just start with your, let's start with something awful. What, and maybe it will sort of walk us through your journey, how you got there, and then we'll talk about how society sort of set up the table for this particular brand of, societal perspective, which brought us this toxic troll army.
Sure.
But tell us about something awful. Like, what was your involvement in that? What was that?
It was a website in the 90s. It still exists. It was a sort of toxic forum where there was sort of like the depth of kind of dark humor and 90s nihilism was expressed there. So it was about kind of self-hating gamers who would kind of make fun of dropping out and playing games and hating sort of this like commodified lifestyle where you're just sort of like hanging out. You've dropped out of life and you're very nihilistic. And that evolved. That spawned another site called 4chan, which was even more nihilistic and sort of even more about dropping out and playing video games all day. And that slowly evolved sort of into a political movement, first on the left, and then it spawned the far right. So that's sort of in a nutshell, that's what the book is about, tracing that history of the alt-right, which came out of this anime website, or this sort of set of websites about playing video games and dropping out of life.
All right, so let's track that, how nihilism turns into a, I maybe hesitate to say a political movement, but certainly almost a strange political ideology of sorts. Tell folks like what, and I think most people by now know what 4chan and 8chan are, but
right.
What is 4chan and 8chan?
They are online message boards, anonymous for the most part, so you don't have to say who you are when you post, and they're sort of known first as sort of anime-themed message boards, but also known for really dark, cynical content, and they've spawned a variety of sociologically important things like memes. They more or less invented the idea of memes, and then they invented then Anonymous, the sort of far left hacktivist collective, came out of 4chan around 2008, and then they largely spawned the alt right around 2014-2015. So very large internet message boards that sort of, to me, I argue, are sort of the center of a sort of type of youth counterculture that then sort of evolves into political movements.
Now, the people, as you talk about these sort of different eras of 4chan, right? Anonymous and then Gamergate, I guess, and maybe
right.
The alt-right and whatnot. These are not necessarily the same people, right? They're different generations of people who are like adopting parts of the generation that was prior to them. And by generation, I'm using the term, I guess, maybe a little loosely or you know, a little specifically, not necessarily, although maybe we're speeding up in that way. But I mean, is that right?
Right. We, in some sense, I sort of use these sites to kind of make a sociological argument about sort of trends and sort of to understand the phenomenon of like why suddenly in 2015 there's this huge fascist movement on this very popular message board. But actually going out and speaking to people from the sites, people using the sites and going out and finding sources for the book, some of them are the same, right? Some of them kind of have gone through the whole thing. For the most part, the far left anonymous hacktivist group are different. So part of why the far right movement spawned was there was a quote-unquote moral vacuum where all those people left. A lot of people grew up, left the site. But a lot of folks sort of, the idea is that you sort of have this vast disenfranchised group of people who were sort of ever more marginalized, right? Like after the 2008 crash, they were just sort of men that just dropped out. They never came back. And they ended up, well, in that case, you're on the internet, you're hanging out, and the people who were there in 2005 and were like, haha, I'm dropping out of life, I'm a Gen Xer, I'm like, a life sucks, you know, then 20 years passes, right? And like, the idea is that how long can you be a nihilist? How long can you do that? And the answer is not long, right? So at first they try the left. They're like, all right, well, we're going to break out of our mom's basements and we're going to have this hacktivist political movement that is going to destroy big, you know, a big government or the industrial complex or big corporations. But that gets crushed by the FBI around 2012. And there's still a lot of people left. And there's new kids, right? So the phenomenon of, like, the idea that, like, oh, you're 19, you're 20, and still life sucks. You get to be shuffled into a cubicle, or you get to work at Taco Bell. Well, the idea of that, like, video games and the internet, all that stuff's expanding. Those worlds are more enthralling than ever. So, like, that idea that 4chan invented that, like, in 2005 you'll drop out, the kids in 2015, they're like, yeah, more than ever I'm going to do that. So then that culture gets inherited, right? So it's sort of like a rolling ball that just keeps going, where like the phenomenon, the underlying phenomenon that created it is still there. So 4chan's culture just keeps ballooning and then creating new politics that float up to the political sphere.
Do we have an analog? I mean, because it feels like there is something structural about the internet and more narrowly, you know, like an existing message board, that we don't necessarily have an analog for past generations. So if and you start the book out talking a little bit about the counterculture in the 60s and how in many respects it became absorbed by the culture and then commodified and sold back to us in many ways, like The Gap, for instance,
right.
San Francisco. But it was very hard to maintain whatever feelings or attitudes there were from the late 60s, because there was no third place, if you will, where the dynamic was static. So, and maybe I'm not articulating that clearly enough, but that an unmoderated, self-maintained, almost, you know, online VFW hall, right?
Right.
Where people could go, and there's obviously like some institutional memory of the attitudes that drove people there in the first place. You know, you've got a lot of misfits, you got a lot of people who are alienated, and this is a place for me to go where I can also sort of redesign who I am in some way.
Right.
It's almost as if, you know, Woodstock existed, never shut down, right? It was constantly rolling for years and years. Obviously, you know, that the ethos from the original Woodstock would live on longer. And it sort of feels like that's happened with 4chan. But the core basis of that ethos, which is like we live outside of things, was the only thing that changed. And sort of what filled it changed a little bit. But that core ethos of like, hey, we're in an unmoderated forum where we're outside of things. We're almost outlaws on some level, right? I mean, that seems to be the only thing that maintained through that period.
In some sense, yeah. I mean, I think that's an interesting point. And I agree. All those elements are there, right? The outsider, the rebel, the people that don't want to be part of society or sort of want to make their own rules, right? They'd always have that sort of independent streak. I mean, I guess to sort of put these things, touch on these things in the way that I order them in the book, the idea is that, well, as you sort of described, the internet was created by these out of this sort of 60s counterculture, and they're like, oh, the rebellion will be there, like Woodstock, the new Woodstock will be there. And then instead what occurred was, by the time the 80s and 90s roll around, there's sort of this idea that capitalism will last forever in the American style, that's sort of the end of history, the Fukuyama idea that, like, that was it. And then counterculture from the 90s, which was my generation, we said, oh, well, there's nowhere to go, right? There's only despair, only sort of dropping out and nihilism. And that became this sort of dropping out in the computer world. And so by the early 2000s, you sort of get that nihilistic youth counterculture. They're like, well, where are we going? We're just going in. We're just going to drop out. We're going to live in the screen. And the real world kind of sucks because it doesn't really offer us much. And sort of like what happened, that was 4chan. And so what then happened was, by the time you get to 2008, they're like, they're ready to rebel. They're sort of ready to sort of take action and become hackers, sort of like in that revolutionary sense that was envisioned by the 60s. And they do. It really does happen on 4chan. But when that movement's broken, then sort of like what happens is you get another generation coming in, and they're like, well, now where do we go? We still have that sort of nihilistic idea. Like, more than ever, they're sort of like, well, now there's even less hope for us. And that ends up sort of devolving into the alt-right. And but that, to touch on the other point that you talked about, where it's new, right? The new part is that there's sort of this echo chamber effect, where it turns out, sort of unique to the internet, that if you get a bunch of people together, they're going to encourage really bad behavior among themselves. So whether that's sort of FinSpo inspiring to be sin, or sort of incels, and sort of where you're like, oh, we all get together and like, we're all going to decide that we're doomed. We're never going to go outside. We're never going to have romantic partners, right? So there's sort of, that was the new effect. But the other part's very old, right? So like the idea that in 2015, 2016, and 2017, you get like young people becoming communists and young people becoming fascists, and they're battling on the streets because capitalism once again has become so unequal and sort of so dysfunctional, right? That's old. It's just expressing itself again through the internet, through these weird forums that started out about anime.
does the idea, I mean, because we should talk about Gamergate. I mean, all of this fascinates me for multiple reasons. I mean, I was told when we first went on Air America, we had a website for the Majority Report, which was just an old movable type with just, you know, comments, but we wouldn't blog very much. It really just functioned as a completely unmoderated, you know, chat forum. And we would have anywhere from 20 to 30,000 people a day, mostly through those 3 hours, and thousands of comments per hour, because people, we were pushing people there from the radio site. And I had people who told me that some elements of Anonymous were, you know, would gather there because it was completely unmoderated, and it was it moved quite rapidly and whatnot. And then, you know, 5 or 6 years later, I'm doing this version of the show, and one of my producers at the time who was hosting, you know, wanted to talk about Gamergate, which I had no idea what it was. And I wonder,
why wouldn't you?
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Like, at the time, it was pure garbage, right? It's like, to me, it's like Dennis Rodman visiting North Korea, right? You're like, you just want to forget it. It's pure garbage.
But even then, less like, so, right?
And then, later, you're like, oh, that's the imprint. That's like Donald Trump visiting the same thing, right? Like,
exactly.
It becomes historically important, right?
Exactly. And so, but I mean, there's two things that occur to me about Gamergate. And I want you to tell people what Gamergate was for folks who don't remember. And also the concept of incels. Because one of the things that really seems clear to me is that during this period of time, we have sort of this, you know, to borrow your phrase, a toxic brew of of one, a financial collapse. Right. So you have people who are going through economic hardship, on top of which we're having fairly significant strides in social emancipation, if you will. We have the election of the first African-American president. We have we're hurtling towards marriage equality. We have the election came down to a woman and an African-American man. Everyone anticipated that the next president would be a woman. So we're getting further, you know, sort of social emancipation. And it doesn't surprise me that on some level to be counterculture at this moment in time is to essentially be a conservative reactionary. And certainly there were those people who are trying to sort of build this ideology during the aughts, but it wasn't quite there because things were pretty, it was not clear where the culture was going in terms of this stuff. But by 2008, there was a sense of like, it's going in not the direction the conservatives of the George Bush movement had. So tell us what Gamergate came out of, because to me, as I've told people about it, it's like, I'm basically telling you a story that you probably encountered in junior high. But it grew into something massive.
So yeah, it was sort of this piece of cultural garbage in 2014. It was sort of a harassment campaign that started on 4chan. So 4chan was part of this, or really the center of troll culture, where they would gang up and harass people, and that turned before into this hacktivist movement where they'd harass Scientology or a government. But in 2014, the people left there harassed a game developer, and the idea was they were insulted that she was bringing feminism to games, essentially. That was their complaint. There was a bunch of other hyper detail that sort of not really relevant.
Well, but I do think this is relevant insofar as it was a guy who broke up with a girl, or a girl who broke up with a guy. And the guy basically created this narrative.
He was sort of a jilted ex or something, and he posted this long angry screed to kind of inspire the angry young men on 4chan. He knew already that this woman, Zoe Quinn, the game developer, was already being targeted already by sort of the incel community at that point. And so he sort of like wanted to rally them. So he created this long angry post, and he's like, these are all the horrible things she did. And it just became this huge harassment campaign, like bigger almost than any personal harassment campaign 4chan had ever done. And so the idea is like, well, where did all that passion come from? Why did they mobilize around that? And the idea was then full of young men who had really just dropped out in a way that was more than any other in the past, sort of more otaku, more hikikomori is sort of the Japanese term for it, where you're just withdrawing, living life by the computer and convincing themselves that they would never go out, they would never have a romantic partner, they would never succeed in life, that they were on the bottom. And so this idea that like, oh, I can't go into a video game and then seduce a woman in the video game and sort of have these misogynistic fantasies in my video game, well, that's my only retreat. That's the only place I can go. So they got really mad. And this was their way, their really immature, kind of deranged way of expressing it. But that coalesced into a political movement. After that movement, unfortunately, all these young men on 4chan and 8chan, they realized, oh, we have this sort of thing in common. We are similar. We don't like feminism. And at the time, what happened was, as the coalition was forming, there were sort of these hucksters on YouTube that would be like, oh, well, I'll be your mouthpiece. I'll speak for you. I'll be kind of like your stand-in dad for the guy, for the young men living, like raising themselves on the internet. And that was Milo Yiannopoulos. That was Mike Cernovich. That was Sargon of Akkad, whatever. All these, like, sort of now it's a cottage industry of conservative YouTube dads kind of like raising these kids online. But like back then, that was sort of the first wave. They were gamer gators. Yes. And that just evolved. That was 2014. So 2015, Gamergate peters out. Trump starts.
Now, hold on for one second. Let me just say something about 2014 so people understand how this grows. I mean, because it is an astonishing story that we're really talking about a guy who breaks up with a girl and then basically harnesses the misogyny that is existing, and they use to basically talk about this. It was literally, and I just remember this, that people were complaining about the lack of ethics in gaming journalism.
Yeah, that was their line, right?
They felt this woman was getting...
It was totally fabricated. It was nonsense, right? It turns out it was a typo in the guy's street. He thought, the way that he wrote it, he's like, oh, maybe she sort of knew this guy that wrote a review of her game, but it turned out not to be true.
Right. So, and yeah. It ended up being this whole notion of, but it's, I think it's important too, because it's relevant that it's an attack on the media. Now, I don't take gaming media seriously. I apologize. Gaming reviews, I know it's important, obviously, to people who read games. But this is setting up a structure of attacking an institution, which is the gaming media, to the extent that there was one. And I think there was one. And like you say, there was a couple of YouTube hucksters who realized, if I cover this stuff and I become their champion, I'm going to make a lot of money and achieve a certain amount of celebrity. And that's exactly what happened.
Right. And, you know, the game media at the time, they knew for the most part, they're like, look, these companies have trained these young men to be consumers, right? Gamergate described itself as a consumer revolt. And the idea was like, we want this out of our product. We want this out of our game. And like the idea was that that's all they had, right? Their whole life was sort of defined by dropping out, kind of consuming stuff, mostly just online products at their computer, right? So it's like you can see how that lifestyle is nihilistic and sort of desperate and longing in that void for something, for someone to come in and then be like, well, let me give you 12 rules to live your life or whatever, right? Yeah. Like. Right. It's like Peterson who replaced Yiannopoulos, right? Like, let me tell you how to pull yourself up by your boot. Let me give you an off the rack value system because you have nothing, because you're sort of living in this sort of like hyper nihilistic, unhappy life.
Indeed. And so we have that in 2014, and then it begins to, it feels like it begins to collapse under its own weight, right? Like the idea of ethics in gaming journalism only has so much durability. And now we're in 2015.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, what happens is that, it can't play out for long. So 2015, the same men who are on YouTube who are sort of purporting to be leaders of the movement, they need a new cause. And Trump is just starting his campaign. It turns out sort of Trump is uncannily sort of replicates their issues, right? They are young men who feel like they're on the bottom of society, and Trump's message is, oh, I'm gonna have you win so much you're gonna get sick of winning. Well, who is that message to but losers, right? People are like, man, one day I'm really gonna win. So it was people who are sort of disenfranchised, and before they hadn't been a political coalition. They were the margins of other political coalitions. But now it's sort of like, oh, these young men under 40 who had dropped out of life, well, we're going to sort of form our own coalition, and we're going to rally around this guy who looks like a loser outsider. But at the same time, he's sort of like projecting what they imagine is success in life, which is sort of like an alpha male, right? That's, they invented all this terminology where they imagined that like life was like a cruel competitive hierarchy. And they're on the bottom, but the idea is like, oh, I win if I get to the top. And that's, of course, the same sort of like ideology that, that Trump holds, right? That he's like the, I quote a philosopher, Hannah Arendt, who talks about the idea that like, oh, well, it's someone who would be flattered at calling being called a bloodthirsty animal, right? Like the idea that like you're a hyper-competitive businessman and all my friends are rivals, right? So it's weird that the men at the bottom felt this, but in fact, it was that same ideology that sort of drifted down to them, where they felt a union with those people like Bannon and Trump at the top.
Well, now that union with someone like Bannon was not necessarily a mistake, right? Because Bannon, and we should say Bannon at this point is running Breitbart, essentially. He's getting funding, as far as I can tell, from the Mercers. That money may have been secured before Breitbart died. And Breitbart, I specifically remember, got about an $11 million infusion into the Breitbart site about a year before he died, somewhere around there, from some private firm at a time where there was virtually no traffic on that Breitbart site. Breitbart, who believed that politics is down culture, or downstream, I should say, from culture, that infused the ideology of that site. So how did Milo end up at Breitbart? Did Bannon basically see this building and say, I'm going to, this is energy that we can use?
I mean, it's a crazy story, and you're right, right? So it seems like a grassroots movement at first, but whatever part was grassroots, Steve Bannon, at the head of Breitbart at the moment, in 2015, took it and spent all that Mercer money to promote it through Yiannopoulos, right? So Yiannopoulos had been at Breitbart a little bit earlier, so he was already writing for Breitbart when Gamergate hit, and then he sort of switched to Gamergate, so they had already met, and he'd already been hired. And the idea is that Bannon and Yiannopoulos learned about 4chan and 8chan and these groups through Gamergate. And by 2015, Bannon shares a lot in common with them, and I argue in my book, he likes the same fascist philosophers that 4chan and 8chan were becoming enamored of, right? Like, he is into sword and sorcery. Like, his company is called Glittering Steel, right? He wrote these sort of hyper-masculine, sort of video game-style screenplays. So he loves this population, and he says, the quotes I have in the book are something like, he's like, these young, disenfranchised white males have monster power, and they come in through Gamergate or whatever, and now they're going to vote for Trump. So he gives Milo Yiannopoulos $1 million. They meet at the Cannes Film Festival. Mercer, Bannon, and Yiannopoulos meet. They give Yiannopoulos $1 million, and they say, go on tour. And Yiannopoulos goes on a tour that he calls the Dangerous Faggot Tour. And this just ends up in the bloody riots and the sort of clashes with Antifa that we see in 2016, at the end of 2016, and then continuing, sort of snowballing and spiraling in 2017 until it ends in Charlottesville, which is sort of the last most awful one, though they still go on a little bit, but not as much.
And this is it's so stunning to me how this all came out of essentially the spark was essentially this guy getting jilted by a woman, and this the strength of this misogyny. And we should say too, like, the I've said this ad nauseum on this program, but there's a multitude of reasons why Hillary Clinton lost, but misogyny is certainly one of them. And to have this, so much of what is going on, at least online, a function of the misogyny. And my question to you is, like, you know, and I know the book is that this troll army memed Donald Trump into office, but it really is more that this is indicative of perhaps a certain mentality that was existing, that Donald Trump took advantage of both in real life and online on some level. But to what extent do you think that this was used by Bannon to create, I mean, how do you think this was leveraged by him?
It was leveraged fairly well. He was sort of ahead of the curve at that point and realized that there was sort of this new coalition of young men that would vote for Trump, which is sort of unusual, right? The idea that in 2016, 2017, youth counterculture sort of breaks, a piece breaks off and it kind of goes to the far right is pretty wild.
But it's not that many votes, right? I mean, they didn't get that many votes.
Yeah, right. But the idea is that the question of how many people voted is sort of, or how much it matters sort of culturally is sort of a different issue, right? So, you know, it's not like this is the entire Trump coalition, right? There's sort of, there's still sort of all of these, you know, one percenters who love that Trump's in office and all of these fooled white working class voters in the middle of the country, right? And then there's these people, right? So it's one coalition that Bannon realizes will also vote for him and also sort of be the sort of cutting edge of meme creation. So like when Donald Trump tweets himself as Pepe the Frog, right? That's a 4chan symbol of loserdom. And when Donald Trump does it, he tags Breitbart in it, right? Like, so the idea is that they're sort of generating this sort of like cultural campaign that is going to look that makes Donald Trump look sort of cutting edge and right. Hillary look like behind the curve because she always is a little behind the curve already, right? So like it kind of reemphasizes that. I mean, they've since sort of become disenfranchised or a little disenchanted with Trump, right? The Trump's incompetence has fragmented this coalition a little bit, but it still exists. It's just they're not too enamored of Trump anymore.
So where does this, I mean, this phenomena that you write about, does it, where is it? I mean, place it for us, right? Because I'm looking at like, you know, we have, let's say the IDW, right? Where someone like Shapiro comes out of the Breitbart world. Keeps some distance, I think, from that now, but it's not that too far of distance. You know, Peterson and on some level, Sam Harris, these are folks who and Joe Rogan, to a certain extent, even, you know, maybe perhaps a little bit more distant, but they all offer like a direction for young men as to like, this is how you can better yourself and empower yourself. There's a how to quality to that. And we also, you know, we still have sort of the hard alt-right, although they seem to have lost some traction. Bannon seems to be adrift. Like, where are these people? Is this phenomena over and it's just mutated into different things or what?
I mean, it's certainly mutating, right? It's on the internet, so it mutates fast, and we've seen it mutate a lot. But it's not over. So Charlottesville, I would say it sort of has two or three sections, right? There was the Gamergate era. Then there's sort of the Trump era where they're emboldened. They go outside. Bannon has mobilized them. And then there's this third sort of post-Charlottesville era where the underlying phenomenon, right, these men still are disenfranchised. They still have very few prospects and sort of hope in their life. And they still sort of live very dark, nihilistic lifestyles, right? Like, life hasn't really gotten better for young people. They're still mired in debt and sort of on the bottom of the economic ladder. So those main causes are still there. So it's still there. The question of what form it takes, well, we now know there's been a lot of good reporting, and I'm still writing on it. And so the idea is that they're back on the internet. They're afraid to go outside. When they do have rallies, I go to the rallies and they're sort of now embarrassed at being humiliated sort of in this culture. Most of them, they used to sort of be bold. Now they're sort of afraid to talk to me a lot of the time, but they're now on the internet and they're hanging out in Discord groups. They're hanging out on 4chan and 8chan. And really when they do go out is when they're so despairing and nihilistic that they want to murder a bunch of people. That was the New Zealand shooting and then the copycat shooting in Poway, California. Those were both 8chan shooters. So it sort of like links into this mass shooter phenomenon where a lot of those guys were alt-right. So it's still there and we don't know what form it's going to take. But as you say, like what happens is these sort of like hucksters at the top, the YouTube dads that are selling a lifestyle and sort of a way to pick yourself out of that lifestyle. Like, they constantly are in the state of shuffling and replacing one another, right? Like, so Yiannopoulos is out and then Peterson gets in or whatever. And that's still there, right? There's still a whole set of them. And it's like, how else do you explain them? Because they're idiots, other than the idea that there's sort of this force bubbling up, pushing them from the bottom, which is this sort of mass. Like, how do they have those big numbers? It's because there's a ton of kids, like, at Taco Bell who are educating themselves and raising themselves online. They don't know. Like, that's the closest they'll get to philosophy.
Who are those YouTube dads now?
I mean, you name them, right? Like, there's Peterson, Gavin McGinnis, Stephen Molyneux or whatever.
Stephon,
like,
Molyneux, yes. I mean,
yeah. No, yeah, like, there's so many of them. And of course, like, this is also keys into a larger sociological phenomenon where if you're just that age, no matter what your political standing, you're on YouTube, you're hanging out on Discord, you're right. Probably not reading much. Like, I work as a college professor and it's hard to get my students to read books, but they're on YouTube constantly, right? So they're just getting all their information from YouTube. So, like, this subset of them who are sort of, like, really despairing and happen to be young men, they're drawn to, like, hang out, in a sense, sort of virtually with these sort of, like, YouTube dads or sort of YouTube gurus who are like, oh, I'll help you out. I'll figure out life for you.
Let me ask you this about, like, how many people do you think we're talking about? Like, when we talk about, you know, people on 4chan, I mean, and you say you go out right. And see them in public. I mean, because I think certainly my own personal experience on, let's say, Twitter, I think I get an outsized notion of how many people are actually on Twitter, because it really is, it feels like everybody's on Twitter, but that's just because I know a narrow set of people and they're all sort of like-minded. And it just so happens to be that is the key demo for, you know, that's the people I follow on Twitter. But Twitter, you know, is not necessarily representative except for, you know, a specific group. Like, how many people are we talking about here? Because on some level, I still think we're living in an era where we have yet to fully socialize. Society is not caught up with social media. Like, we don't, you know, we had a period where it's like, this guy's got 100,000 Twitter followers. We should get him a book deal. And then you find out, well, it doesn't really work that way. But, you know, nobody's going to buy that book necessarily. But how many people are we talking about?
I mean, that's a really good question. I know that, you know, 4chan is still one of the most popular message boards on the internet, right? There's thousands and thousands of posts an hour or something. So these sites get huge numbers. I am not like a pollster, like, I'm not a numbers guy. So I don't know, like, estimating the sort of the size of the population, I probably get the figure very wrong. I mean, I guess, like, I sort of approach from the other end where I'm like looking at someone like Jordan Peterson and you're like, why, right? Like, how does he have a million people listening to him? Like, who are those people, right? So there's sort of like these people who are, to me, not saying very smart things, but they have these huge followings, or Gamergate, right? It's like, well, why did millions of people do this, right? Though, yeah, like, compared to sort of the size of the United States, I'm not sure. I mean, to me, just sort of like teaching college, right? All my students know about this. This is sort of the culture they're in, right? And so I think if you're a young person, this, I've tried to sort of fairly describe young people's culture in general, right? So this is sort of a large aspect of it. This is sort of how they regard their politics and their reality, that it's going through YouTube or going through certain message boards. But I guess that's sort of a dance around the idea that I don't know.
The thing is, it may not be important, right? Like, it's not like, if we had the ability to say, like, we're going to determine that you need to constitute this amount size of the population to legitimately have this type of authority in our society, and you and I had the ability to do that, it would become more relevant. But what's more fascinating is that it could be very few people, and it's creating, it's in charge of our culture. Which is also, frankly, the reality with things like cable news, right? I mean, we have a very small group of people in cable news who are determining what we decide is our news. I mean, it's sort of a fascinating dynamic. Lastly, where do you think it goes from here?
I think it will remain online and we'll probably see another manifestation in the physical world eventually. It's going to, I think, persist as a political coalition of some sort, that it's not going away, and nor are unfortunately the mass shootings are going away either, that they've still gone on every month or so. So I think if the underlying causes are addressed, if in some way the left has better answers for this coalition, right? Like actual real ways out of poverty, sort of actual real opportunities. If I think the left does well in the next election cycle and reaches out to them, then the coalition could be broken up, right? Like, for example, weirdly, like on 8chan and 4chan, like, 2 or 3 months ago, half the coalition was like, oh, no, we don't like Trump anymore. We like Andrew Yang because we want $1,000 a month, right? So it's sort of like this pseudo-libertarian socialism or whatever sort of brand of socialism that is like, or something like that. They're like, that's what we want. We're not fascist anymore, right? Because it's all teenagers, right? It's, or older men who act like teenagers, but that still means they're mercurial and very variable, and they're in a constant state of identity crisis. So it can be broken up. Does it look like it's going to be broken up anytime soon? Right now, maybe not.
I guess we will have to wait and see. The book is It Came From Something Awful, How a Toxic Troll Army Accidentally Memed Donald Trump Into Office, Dale Barron. We will put a link to your book at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Hey, folks. And now we've got a bit of a post-roll. Another ad to tell you about. Throwback to Sam for that one as well. Sam loves cutting the ads, folks.
Let me remind you, you have the chance to know your dog better than Fur Deep with the most accurate dog DNA test that is on the market, probably ever, that has ever been developed in the history of the world. I mean, it's a relatively recent phenomena with dog DNA testing, right? I'm talking about the Embark Dog DNA Test Kit. It looks over 250 different breeds. It does 170 different genetic health conditions to help you care for your dog. Look, the bottom line is, it's not just about knowing, like, oh, my dog is part terrier, part golden retriever, part German shepherd. What the heck was going on here? It's also, and vets will recommend this quite often, apparently, you get a sense of how you should be feeding your dog. People love their animals. I don't need to tell you this if you're a dog owner or a cat owner for that matter, but for dogs in particular. And the idea that you can feed your dog better or provide them or be on the watch out for any type of potential diseases and help them is huge. And right now for our listeners, Embark has an exclusive summer offer you can't get anywhere else. Go to EmbarkVet.com. Use a promo code majority. Save 15% off your dog DNA test kit. You can discover your dog more than Fur Deep. Visit Embark, EMBARK, vet.com. Use the promo code majority to save. Quick break in a minute. Michael, tell us about Tuesday.
Nice. That was a good throw. Well, there's actually, we're off next week on TMVS, but this past Tuesday we talked with Shahid Buttar, who's running for Congress against Nancy Pelosi.
Who, frankly, is a pretty unexpected data point in how good candidate interviews go, because he was excellent.
Stunning.
Oh, yeah.
That was an innately good interview. That was the highest bar for candidate interviews.
You didn't have to worry about getting to the end of his fluency on any sort of topic. He had his own sort of rich wells to draw on.
Just it was amazing
stuff.
Conversation.
I met him at the DSA convention. He was pretty cool, and he even did a really good rap at the Street Fight Trillbilly show.
Wow.
Did you know that he could rap?
I did not. I knew he was a DJ, apparently. But
he's got many talents.
That would be that is like one of the biggest. I mean, the only other upgrade that I could imagine in terms of just the extreme improvement would just straight up be Sanders over Trump. The idea of having him in Congress instead of Nancy Pelosi is definitely like New Day, Garden of Eden kind of stuff. Anna Kasparian and I talked about extremism on the right, incitement, and building a little bit of a better left culture. Also, Israel-Palestine. Bunch of other things were covered. Patreon.com/TMBS. Next week, it will not be video, but on the podcast feed, it will be unlocked, available for everybody. Liz Franzik, who is the co-host of TruAnon, will join me for a deep dive into Jeffrey Epstein and just the rot, disgusting, grotesque rot of intelligence agencies and American oligarchy. And actually, can Epstein be a launching point for some form of sort of class consciousness? Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Thanks to our over 71,000 subscribers there. Our now well over 2,600 patrons. See you there. Thank you. Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have on Molly Crabapple, friend of the show, to talk about her arrest at the Amazon ICE protest last week, as well as the massive wave of protests in Puerto Rico and what's next for the Puerto Rican people.
Awesome.
We also have a bonus coming out tomorrow, wherein Molly goes through and translates some of the lyrics of the official song of the protest. I'm talking about Afilando los Cuchillos by Bad Bunny, Ile, and Residente, and it gives us a whole new appreciation for the song. So that is out tomorrow for our patrons, patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt.
Yeah, George. I've been doing my patron-only George Orwell series, but so check that out. We got two new episodes on George Orwell on his time in Burma, and we get into some of the more problematic elements of Orwell, so you've been waiting for that. And we're going to release one of the earlier episodes of that for everybody else as I go on vacation. Well, I mean, kind of vacation to Chicago.
Yeah, we're going to Chicago. We're going to be live in Chicago Saturday. Folks, also... found out something extremely annoying, and I don't know how many people this has affected, but she was tweeting at us on Twitter yesterday, basically saying the link at the Lincoln Tavern was broken. And so somebody was trying to buy a couple of tickets to the TMBS live show in Chicago and couldn't do it because there was a problem on the website. I don't know whether that problem has been solved or not. We love the people at Lincoln Hall. Maybe a bit less... We've communicated with them less than folks at other venues, unfortunately. But if for whatever reason you're having a problem, just show up at the door and come on in. We'll see you August 24th, Lincoln Hall, Chicago, with Chuck Meritz. We'll be right back, folks.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.